Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How you doing today, Matt?
Greetings, mortals!
And that's pretty much appropriate for what we're doing today. So today we are going to be finishing out the Diablo class lore discussion with our final three. At least as of this time. If they add more in the future, we'll cover some more. But for right now, the last three that we have are the Assassin, the Demon Hunter, and the Witch Doctor. And I think starting with the Assassin probably isn't a terrible thing, since we ended last one with the Amazon, and there is a direct tie there. So Matt, what do you have to say about the Assassin?
There's no direct tie there.
Is there not?
No. The Assassins are related to the Sorcerers and Wizards.
Oh, well then correct me, please. Educate me.
The Assassins started in the Mage Clan Wars. The Vizgerai were doing a lot of demon summoning, and after that war, they realized demon summoning is bad. Demons are bad. Who knew? So they came up with a ban on that. They were like, you can't use demonic magic anymore. You can't summon demons. But they knew mages tend to do things they're told not to do. Hey, there's a way to get extra power, and you're telling me not to do it. That makes it even more tantalizing. So they created the, and I can't pronounce this, so if I get this, I mean, it's a made-up word, so the Vizjektar. And the Vizjektar were basically just called mage hunters, or mage killers. They're basically designed to hunt down and kill mages that have broken the sanctum against... sanction against demonic summoning. You cannot do that, and if you do it, they show up and kill you. That's their job. So that's basically their history. They originally come from, you know, the I keep forgetting the name of the country. The Chaldeans, a city, but I can't remember the name of the country, and I know I should remember it. Do you remember the name of the country?
No, we did this exact same thing last week. let's see here. I believe...
Kedjistan,
yep. I just found the map.
I always forget that. They're from Kedjistan initially, but you know, nowadays they tend to recruit from all over. That's their deal. They basically are trained from like very young age to be skilled at killing mages. I don't know this guy's deal. His name was Lam Essen. And he studied like ancient magic and the effects of demon summoning. He's the first guy to have written the story of Anu and Tathamet. We don't know how he learned this stuff. He studied the old religion or Skatsim, which was this kind of weird old. It's pre Zakharum spirituality and magic practice, and he studied that. And using what he learned from that is where he got the knowledge about the Burning Hells and the Primevals. And as a result, he basically penned the book on how to deal with people who've been corrupted by demons. And that book was used by the Vizierai to create their assassins. Interestingly enough, though, that book was suppressed by the Zakharum, because the Zakharum had an inquisition where they suppressed all other religions. And, you know, Sketsim was one of the religions that they suppressed, probably because by this point the Zakharum were invaded by Mephisto, and they wanted to, you know, get rid of anything that would allow people to fight demons more successfully. But they couldn't really go after the assassins because the Vizierai were so powerful, and to directly antagonize the Vizierai might mean that they would figure out what was going on in the Zakharum. And that was the last thing that they wanted. So the assassins kind of got to hang out and still be doing what they were doing. So they're sort of like monks, kind of. I mean, both in the way they fight and in, you know, the arts they practice, but they get them from a different source.
I was going to say, don't they not directly practice the arts? I thought that they, the whole deal with the thought of the corruption was that they used items instead.
Yeah, they don't use magic at all, but they study it.
Yeah.
They hone their natural, like, fighting abilities, and they do it, like, the practices they use, the training of the book, is such that they actually do get magical abilities, but they're kind of like, it's more like anti-magical abilities. Like, if you think about it in terms of, it's not too dissimilar from the Templars from Dragon Age, where you have people who learn how to disrupt magic, how to kill mages, how to destroy demons. That's what the assassins are all about. But they do use a lot of enchanted items and ingenious devices instead of using magic directly. They don't use magic directly.
Yeah, and I find that absolutely fascinating, because, like, the idea that any magic can become a corrupting force is intriguing, right? And it's something that I think is not unique, but you don't generally see a lot of in fantasy settings. Even in grimdark fantasy settings, you don't generally see, like, oh, you know, just magic in general could potentially cause you to become supremely corrupted, right?
I don't think that that's quite accurate. It's not the magic that makes you corrupt. It's the fact that you're human. Because humans have in them, in the Diablo setting, humans are, you know, part angel, part demon. All humans have both essences within them, which is why humans can choose to do either. And magic gives you the ability to do more. So if you, like, using magic, it's inherently part of humanity to be corruptible. You have that within you. You have, like, the old concept of, you know, I've got an angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other. That's literal in the Diablo setting. So if you're an arcane magician, you are always being tempted to use magic that some calls on demons and summons demons. And that's the thing. It's not that the magic itself did anything. It's that you, using the magic, decided to reach out, even though you knew it was a bad idea, because it would benefit you.
That's fair.
It's the selfishness of it. So it's not, there's plenty of Vizierai who never once get corrupted. You can be a mage all you want. It's when you choose to use this forbidden magic that reaches out to the Hells. And that, to me, is fascinating, because that's why, you know, necromancers, you don't hear a lot of demonic and corrupted necromancers, although there are necromancers who are using demonic magic. But the ones who are members of the Priests of Rathma, almost never, because they don't even learn that magic. They don't learn those spells. And it's fascinating to me how it's not, like, you know, the kind of magic you're using isn't the problem. It's just, do you know how to make a deal with a demon?
Hmm.
You know, yes, yeah, if you do, and you do it, then that's the problem. And that's why the Vizierai have I cannot pronounce this word to save my life. I'm just going to say the assassins from now on, because the Vizjaktar were created because they knew everybody's possibly corruptible. Everybody could be, you know, could fall into this. And we've seen what it does, because the Mage Clan Wars were a directly result of people summoning demons. And that's something they were not willing to ever go through again. So it's interesting, you know, the assassins, they don't really have, I don't know how to explain this. They don't have that kind of relationship with magic like other people do. They don't cast spells, as you pointed out.
Yeah, and I think that definitely manifests itself in the game. So, like, if you were to play Diablo 2, you would see that, like, shadow traps and things like that, the things that they're using are physical devices that they're throwing down that cause those elemental energies to actually manifest, which I think is also very, very interesting, because I think the only other group that really mentions using artifacts or items in that way is the Haradrim, right?
Like, we don't really... the Demon Hunters do.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that next, probably as soon, once we're done with the assassins here. But please continue.
Oh, continue what?
So, is there, I guess then my other question is, with everything that was going on during Diablo 3, why do we, do we have an idea of why we didn't see any assassins?
I mean, partially because Emperor Hakan was, controlled by Belial, I would think. I would assume that any Vizdrai who were in the area vacated it fairly quickly rather than stay there and potentially get destroyed by all these demons that were swarming out of the woodwork. That would probably be part of it. Also, I don't know what happened. We're probably going to find out more. This is why Diablo Immortal is so useful to us as people who study Diablo lore, because we don't know a lot about a lot of these things, and we're going to get a chance to see what happened between Diablo 2 and Diablo 3. Like, one of the things that we're going to, to go again to the Demon Hunter, who we're going to talk about in a bit, a lot of the origins of the Demon Hunters are directly going to be talked about in Diablo Immortal and haven't been talked about yet. Like, as of right now, we don't know where the Demon Hunters come from, other than we know the physical location they're currently in. We don't know, how they got started. We don't know. So it's very possible that the Assassins trained them or somehow contributed to them, because their fighting styles are different. Yeah, their fighting styles are different, but they have the same basic approach to demons, and they do both use traps and stuff. I mean, the turrets and traps that Demon Hunters use are mechanically similar to the stuff that the Assassins did. Not the same, but similar. In terms of what they've been up to, though, I don't really know. There's really nothing in game. Nothing in Diablo 3 says what happened to them. The Vizjaktar just don't show up after Diablo 2.
So here's another question. I remember there being a tie between the Assassins and Ormus. Ormus was a NPC vendor, a magic vendor, or mage that happened to be a vendor in Diablo 2. Did anything ever come of that? Do we know if Ormus is still around?
No, not as far as I know. I don't know anything. I know there was some argument that the spiritual teachings that the Assassins used to become the Assassins, the book of the Lan Esem, that the teachings were similar to that of the Tan clan. And Ormus was in the Tan clan. He was a member of it. But in terms of he used to be a really great mage. He probably would have had, we know that the Vizjaktar were watching him, but I don't think they were related. They just trust him.
Yeah. As a possible target, possible that he might have been corrupted, yeah. Right?
Yeah. And he's the one, Ormus is the one who's you got to go through the Infernal Gate to stop Diablo. That's so whatever happened with Ormus, he ended up being part of that. And then you don't see him again ever. He doesn't seem to show up, but he was a follower of Skatsim. It should be pointed out the same school that the Lan Esu book comes from. So he was one of the people who was actually oppressed by the Zakharum Inquisition after Mephisto took over the church. But to my knowledge, there's never been anything again after Diablo 2. We don't hear anything about Ormus. Again, maybe Diablo Immortal will show us what happened to him.
See, and I think that's one of the things I'm most interested in with Diablo Immortal as well, is that in-between time is one of the more fascinating things. Like you pointed out, we don't know a lot of what happened in between Diablo 2 and Diablo 3. In fact, we know almost nothing. And it would be it's very intriguing to see what things break down, because there is a sizable time gap between the two events, right? I forgot how many years there is, but there's a chunk between the two. I want to say it's at least 18 years, something like that. How old is Leah? 16?
I thought it was 25.
Is it 25? Okay.
But give me a sec. I can tell you exactly, because I was just looking at the timeline, but I don't have it up in front of me right this moment.
All right. Well, I think that fascinates me, though, because that's a lot of time between events. That's a lot of time for things to happen. And we talked about this when we talked about the druids and a lot of the other stuff, the other classes and their interactions with Diablo as far as the world around them goes. And because Diablo 3 and the events therein were such a drastic event, there was sort of, I don't want to say a calm, because it wasn't calm in between the two. But there was a certain period of like almost preparation, cleanup and preparation and trying to get ready. And some of those classes, assassins included, I'd be fascinated to see what they did. And like you mentioned, and we're probably going to go into this in a moment, there is a potential tie between assassins and demon hunters in the fact that maybe, just maybe, we find out that the assassins left the homeland to keep themselves safe, wound up going out into the world, finding those that were ravaged by demons, and decided to take the fight in a completely different manner. Because the assassins were essentially lone operatives that, I mean, they used tricks and guile and shadows to eviscerate their targets, right? They were in a lot of ways similar to, I guess, the rogue that we've been seeing be sort of brought back for Diablo 4 with them being an assassin and claiming victims and trophies therein, except they didn't claim trophies necessarily. They found those that were corrupted and killed them. But if they needed to take the fight in a different manner and potentially were the ones that trained the demon hunters, that could be very, very fascinating. And I think it would actually be kind of cool.
Well, right now I can tell you this. The end of Diablo 2, Lord of Destruction, is in 1265.
Okay.
The beginning of Diablo 3 is 1285. That's when Tyrael manages to regain his physical form.
So 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years between those two. The events of Diablo Immortal take place in 1270.
So 5 years after
the... And that's when supposedly the Demon Hunters were formed. I'm going to just go into it now because there's no point in waiting.
Sure, yeah, let's go right into it.
The Demon Hunters basically form in 1270. They're in the Dreadlands. So in the area, the former home of the barbarian peoples, amongst others, the demons poured out of the world wound inside Mount Ararat and began rampaging across the area. The Demon Hunters are being formed in that area. There's not a lot of them. There was maybe a couple hundred of them, and they didn't have an allegiance to any nation. They wanted to hunt demons and demon spawns. And essentially, to get into the Demon Hunters, you had to lose like a home or a loved one or something. You had to be one of their victims, essentially. And so it's an organization rooted in vengeance, which is different than the assassins. The assassins were not about vengeance. They were basically just, this needs to be done. We will, you know, protect our homeland and, you know, prevent this horrible thing that happened from happening again. So they are different, and they're also different in outlook. Like, one person once pointed out, the Demon Hunter plays a lot like if you took the Assassin and the Amazon and you made one class out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right down to the Demon Hunters using two different kinds of these, like the Discipline and Hatred. You know, they have two different power sources that they switch between for abilities. But in terms of like their focus on fighting demons, their use of mechanical things like explosives and turrets and so forth is similar to the assassins' traps and so forth. There are similarities between the two, and for that matter, between the Demon Hunters and the Amazons. So it's quite possible that some Amazoners involved in this, but we don't know. Could have been a rogue too, for that matter. What we do know is that it apparently started forming about 5 years after Diablo was destroyed, because the Worldstone fragments were scattered all across the world, and apparently various demonic servants of hatred were attempting to use the Worldstone fragments to basically bring Diablo back. I guess they didn't know what he was up to, so they were just trying to get those fragments and bring Diablo back, and the Demon Hunters rose to stop it. For instance, the character Vala, we know that she was just starting her training in 1270. She lost her sister and began training at that time. We know she's going to pop up in Diablo Immortal.
I also think it's fascinating that, unlike a lot of the other classes, Demon Hunters are unique in the fact, or I would say mostly unique, that they don't owe any allegiance to a particular country or king or religion. They're made up of the disparate scraps of those that have been afflicted by the demonic invasions, right? So the membership inside of the Demon Hunters is not part of a religious cult, or an organization brought back or brought forth by, you know, an Inquisition or a king or anything like that. These are literally just people who have had what they care about stripped away. Like you mentioned, Vala. Vala begins her training in 1270. And like you said, it's because she lost her sister, basically to, a demon, right? Like a demon took her sister from her. Or in this particular case, the witnessing of what happens with seeing your family butchered by demons, caused a madness in her sister that, you know, caused her to die. We know the exact specifics, but she mentions that she was rescued by survivors who had joined together to rid the world of creatures of hell. They saw in me the strength to resist the demons, and they forged me into a weapon. Now I am ready. A meteor has fallen in Tristram, and the dead have risen in its wake, and I will send them back to their graves. Once I was hunted, now I am the hunter. And it's sort of like that mentality, right? That survivor mentality where it's like, yeah, I'm going to go and take care of this now. Now, the other interesting thing about that is Vala is often referred to as the Order Master. If that's the case, who found her? If it was the Demonic Order, and is the theory of it being one of the Amazons or one of the assassins possibly correct?
We know that she was trained by Josen.
Okay.
Josen was a demon hunter that found her and trained her. He's the one that we don't know who trained him. We know that Vala and her younger sister survived their village getting attacked and destroyed by demons, but Halissa drowned after she woke up from a nightmare. She ran off and fell into the river. Vala couldn't get her out in time. After that happened, Vala was found by Josen. And Josen was the demon hunter. He used to say that everything was a test. That was his big deal. He's the one who was hanging out with her in 1270. He's the one who was training her. He also partnered her with another demon hunter at one point. A guy named Delos, but by 1285, they basically discovered that the things were happening. Delos was corrupted by demons, and they went after him. And it was basically like a whole thing where Josen is the one that sent her to Tristram. Mm-hmm. That was his deal. We don't know who trained him. We don't know how, you know, if the order started sometime around 1270, then he would have been relatively new at it himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's training her when he's barely trained himself. So we don't know who taught him or where he got his instruction from. And again, this is one of the things that I think might be really cool about Diablo Immortal is we might find out, like, who trained Josen? Does Josen have a master? Who was Josen's master? I mean, we don't even know where Josen comes from. We know that he was working with Vala, like, in 1270. Like, again, in Diablo Immortal, the two of them are available. You do quests to help them, and they're both there. So the order existed for at least a couple of years before the events of Diablo Immortal, because otherwise Josen wouldn't have been able to be trained enough to find Vala and help her at all. And both Josen and Vala are effective demon hunters in 1270. So it's possible the order started sometime after the destruction of the World Stone and before the events of Diablo Immortal, but we don't know exactly when or how. And that's the reason that I keep thinking to myself that there might be a connection to the Assassins or the Amazons or both. We know that an Amazon and an Assassin work together trying to stop Baal.
Yep.
Canonically, there's one, you know, if you look at the loading screen, the various characters, I think canonically the party that went after Diablo is made up of all of them. And if even the Druid and the Assassin joined in for Lord of Destruction. So I think canonically they would have worked together. They might very well have decided to train people, but we don't know that for sure. It just fits.
It also depends too largely on the state of the world after the events of Diablo 2 as well, because we've seen other instances of, for lack of a better term, the story being driven by, hey, this thing is no longer available, so now we're going to resettle, or we're going to move, or we're going to have to do something else in order to survive. Like that's sort of like a big theme with a lot of these classes. It's that whole survival aspect of it. And so part of that is becoming or being ready to change where you are, where you're based, or what you're doing. Sometimes you can't go home. Looking at Diablo 3, even sometimes that home's just not there anymore. Perhaps it burned to the ground. Perhaps the angels took it, or demons, or whatever this case. Maybe it got turned into a hellmouth. We've seen that be a thing where, you know, fleshy demonic portals decide to open up inside of it. And well, yeah, no good comes from that. But I think that's one of the things I like about demon hunters in general, is that necessarily doesn't matter. There's almost an aspect of, for lack of a better term, and not to compare it to another IP, but I'm going to do it anyway. It has almost like a Jedi-esque aspect to it, at least with Vala and Jozen, where Jozen trained Vala and they're seen traveling together. And part of that story there, especially with, I believe it was Jozen went after a corrupted member of the, I think it was the person that they worked with before, right?
Darla.
Yeah. So he went after him who had been corrupted. And then Vala had gone after, no, it was Delios. Delios. Vala went after the demon. Jozen went after Delios. And they both took care of it, but they were seen traveling together. So there's almost an aspect, at least, and this could be the case, could not be the case. Again, we don't know the details of it, of maybe they pick somebody to almost be like that student, that underling to learn and to partner with, to a point where they can go out on their own and find somebody else to do that with, or find a survivor to train up. I'm really curious to see what exactly Demon Hunter training looks like, what that actually means. Because again, they don't have like a central base of operations. They don't have a home necessarily. You know, like the Amazons have their island. Even the mages have their bastions of arcane, fortitude or whatever you want to call it. Druids have a place that they can return to.
Skazlan, yeah.
Yeah. So like there's all these places where like, yes, there's a base of operation. There's a heritage or a place where, you know, we can go back to or regroup or learn or do whatever. Even the barbarians have that to a certain extent, whether it's in various states of disarray or whatever it is.
I would argue that they had that.
Now.
That is definitely gone. In fact, at least some of the demon hunters are probably barbarian in origin. They come from the children of Bul'Kathos because that's where they are now.
Mm-hmm.
The Dreadlands is smack dab in the middle of what used to be, barbarian territory. And the barbarians are a fractured people right now. We have no idea. I don't even know like how many of them are left by the time of Diablo 4. They were not doing well in Diablo 3, and that was before like a whole bunch of people got killed by Malthiel. So it's a toss up. We have no idea. But the demon hunters are unique in that they don't have, you don't have to be a member of a certain group. Like the barbarians are all related. They're all the children of Bul'Kathos. Druids come from Skazglen. Those are traditions that are passed on to specific peoples. Demon Hunter, have demons destroyed your life? Yes? Welcome aboard. Here's how to kill them. It's just that simple. We mages decided to create an order to protect ourselves from our own worst impulses. It's demons are bad. Let's kill them. You know, it is a remarkably simple and pure ideology. Demon bad, us kill. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they recruit people who've suffered at the hands of demons is because those people are the most motivated. They realize that, you know, if someone's lost everything to demons, this person's going to be willing to put themselves through the training and the ordeal of the life that will come after it. Like I said, Jozen used to say, all of life is a test. Once you start thinking of all of life as a test, you know, you understand, you know, that this is something that is unrelenting. It's never going to stop. You're never going to win. Winning isn't even the point. This is pure revenge. It's not rooted in, there's no victory condition because there will always be more demons. So you always have to kill more demons. So that's interesting to me, that there's a lot of potential in terms of what they do with it. This is the only, one of the real problems I have with Diablo as a game setting. And this goes back to the first one, from Diablo to Diablo 2, from Diablo 2 to Diablo 3, and now to going to Diablo 4. It's, there's not a lot of continuation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the only class that's been in more than one game, like at launch, is the Barbarian. And the only class that's even seen two games, besides Barbarians, is the Necromancer.
And even the Barbarian, then, barely, for right? Like,
for, as an expansion pack to the game.
Sure.
But the Barbarian's the only one that got to be in Diablo 2, Diablo 3, it's going to be in Diablo 4, and it's going to be in Diablo Immortal. Mm-hmm. That's the only one that gets a through line. We see them over and over again. We saw the Amazon once. We saw the Assassin once. We've seen the Demon Hunter once, but they're going to be in Diablo Immortal, so we'll get to see more of them.
Druid gets to skip one or two.
Yeah, but the thing is there's a lot of these classes. Like, we're talking about the Assassins, and like, what happened to them? Why haven't we seen them again? That is a very good question that we can't answer because they've never been addressed. I would like them to be addressed. I would like to see them again. I think there should be NPCs that are assassins if we're not going to have playable assassins. There should be people out there who are, you know, hunting down demons and killing them, whether they be demon hunters, assassins, or otherwise. But yeah, it is one of the things that is difficult about Diablo as a setting sometimes, is that we don't get a lot of through line. Like, we don't know right now, we don't know if the paladins are all gone. We know we didn't see any.
We have a couple suspects of what might have happened to them after Westmarch.
There might have been some paladins left. Maybe they weren't actually in an order anymore, but they might have still been out there with their, you know, fighting the hosts of hell with the light, but we haven't seen them. We saw a bunch of crusaders in Diablo 3, and we're going to see them in Diablo Immortal, which means that we'll see them before Diablo 3, but we don't look like we're going to get to see them in Diablo 4. Like, you talked about, we don't know what shape the world was in, really, between 1265 and 1285. We know that they considered it a period of quiet, where things started to recover before everything went really, really bad again in 1285. And there's a lot we have yet to see. We don't know what's going on in Skovos. We don't know what the Amazons are doing. We don't know, you know, what's going on in Tien Tsa, you know? There's just, you know, Xian Sai, sorry. We don't know what's going on in Xian Sai. We'll find out about Skazglen in Diablo 4, but we haven't seen it this whole time. Khedistan is crumbling and falling apart. We only heard about the Tarajan jungles really in Diablo 3.
Yep.
Because of the witch doctors, and that's barely, like, we don't know anything about what's going on there in terms of the demons. Did the demons go there? Did the angels show up and start killing people there? You know, we have no idea. We know the crusaders were wandering around the swamp in the very distant east, as far east as you can go, pretty much, for a long time before they finally came out and started wandering the world again. There's a ton of stuff that's just never really been dealt with. I mean, should we talk about witch doctors now?
Yeah, I think that's a really good transition. So the witch doctors, and this is going to be my, to best of my knowledge, because I actually really like the witch doctor class, because I generally enjoy hybrid classes, and witch doctor is definitely a hybrid class. So witch doctors are actually really quite rare. They're not a very common thing, even in Umbaru society. So very, very few men or women ascend to the position, because they have to possess two very distinct things. One, they have to have an extreme prowess in battle, which means that they have to have survived a lot of encounters and essentially been blooded, whether it's fighting against human or not sanctuary-specific creatures, whether it's angels or demons, or any of the various mutations that exist in the swamplands. But on top of that, not only do they have to be militaristically profitable is the wrong word, successful. They have to have the ability to communicate with spirits, which is it's like a latent ability. It's not something that's taught. It's not something that, you know, you can pick up. It's something that you're born with. So they have to have both of those things before they can even start down the path of being a witch doctor. Now, the thing with the communicating of the spirits is that they believe in what's called, or that it's being touched by the unformed lands, which is a central point of Umbaru sort of society and belief structure. The unformed lands, and the belief in it thinks that the mortal realm, so sanctuary itself, is merely a veil for the true reality that is actually the unformed lands, and that it's the witch doctors who can gain insight into that realm. They can actually see it. They can experience it. They can go into what's called a ghost trance in order to actually interact with it. And that's a state of being where they train their minds to perceive that sort of land or that realm beneath the layer of what we call reality, through rituals and herbs, from the Tanganzi, jungle itself, or Tanganzi in general. They can actually spend what they say is minutes in the unformed land, where they can actually see, or interact with the spirits there, talk with them, before they're ripped back to reality in what might only be seconds of our time as we're observing. What the unformed lands actually are, nobody really knows. But this is where they get their power from, their ability to look into it, their ability to connect to it, their ability to ghost trance into it, lets them, they call it dark magic, but it's really just how they manifest their ability to raise the dead, summon plagues, bring forth gigantic monstrosities, in terms of, I can't remember what the heck the name of the thing is, but that looks like a giant construct. And there also is this belief that in that land where they draw this power from, there are gods there. What that means, they have never, ever really truly said, what they actually are, but they're not angels and they're not demons. They are something completely other. Now, the interesting thing is that the only other class that can tap into this spirit realm, that can tap into sort of this layer beneath reality, is the necromancers, where they can actually channel those spirits into the minds of their nearby enemies, to basically, any psychic attack or any sort of like spiritual attack that the necromancer does is drawing on things from that realm. So it's interesting that the witch doctors can do that as well. The Umburu are essentially a decentralized people. They're hunter-gatherers. They leave sacrifices for their gods inside of the ghost realm. Ooh, excuse me. And they tend to occupy spaces that seem to almost need protection. Like when we go through the swamps, one of the things we're doing is we're breaking into tombs and ancient areas that are buried deep beneath that soil, that water. And it almost seems like the Umbaru are almost positioned to try to keep that safe. Now, nothing's ever been said or really linked between the two, but it seems a little too coincidental. Let's see what else about the witch doctor I think is interesting. Oh, the other thing is, like necromancers as well, they can feel when something dies and passes from one realm to the other. And they can actually sense when, like, there are mass murders. So at the end of Diablo 3, when the world has essentially been devastated and like a good chunk of humanity has been wiped out, the witch doctor would have felt every single bit of that. Unlike the other classes, or maybe to a varying degree, I don't know if paladins or crusaders would have felt that in their very bones. The magic wielders might have, druids might have, but the witch doctors definitely did. And what that caused them to do, or how that would have affected them, or the Umbaro society, who, you know, reveres the witch doctor as, I mean, almost akin to what they call their high priests or their rulers, that would be a fascinating thing to see. Like, are they still around? Can they still exist? Are they been laid waste with everything that's happened there? Now, the other thing I think is really cool about the witch doctors is that not only can they use the herbs and things that they find to put themselves in that ghost trance state, they also know how to weaponize it. And that is manifested through summoning the poison clouds, throwing the canoptic jars, using the poison darts to essentially attack their enemies' spirits using their magics from the unformed lands, their bodies through the use of the poisons, as well as their minds. They attack whatever they're going after with everything. And we know that they're able to form poisons that can affect demons, which is also very interesting, because when they're fighting them, you would think that the demons, if they're not part of Sanctuary, wouldn't be affected by natural herbs or whatever the case of their concoctions are. But they very clearly are. And angels as well. So the witch doctor has the ability to, whether it's through channeling the unformed land into whatever tincture or mixture they're making, but they can poison them. They can actually cause them physical harm through this use of what are essentially naturally occurring things in Sanctuary, which I think is absolutely fascinating. It also is it's another pseudo-religious class, I guess, that would kind of fall in line with paladins and crusaders and even mages to a certain degree, where they are informed by a very specific set of tenets it's just way different than everything else. It's very animistic, very spiritual, very multiple gods, not just one greater being, not just believing in the light. And I think that is absolutely fascinating. And I think that due to the nature of their sort of hunter-gatherer-esque society, where maybe they're not staying in one place for too long, they don't really necessarily have established cities, that they might have also been one of the few groups to maybe survive a good portion of the aftermath of Diablo 3 going into Diablo 4. Now, I'm very curious to see if they will pop up in some capacity in Diablo 4, because I want to see... I'm curious how they would interact with the Necromancers if the Necromancers are working with Lilith, and how they would work with Lilith. Like, how that interaction would go down. Would they view Lilith as another god, even though she's a demon? Would she be just somebody who was brought back from unexistence, but maybe that unexistence was the unformed land? It seems to sort of be in that same wheelhouse. Is that where things that are banished from Sanctuary go? Is it sort of like this, I hate to say it, like, it is it the Shadow Realm? Is it this layer that just encompasses everything, including death? Because that's the other thing I don't think has ever really been established in Diablo lore, is where does a soul go when it dies?
Well, I mean, the Necromancers have the theory that they go to the Plane of the Dead. And there are some people who think the Plane of the Dead is the Unformed Lands, that they're the same place.
Okay.
I should point that out. We know that one of the things that drove Malthiel insane, in fact, was that when he went to where the Worldstone had been before Inarius stole it, he found mortal spirits going there, collecting there. And he was like, why is this happening? Why are they here? So it's possible that the Unformed Lands and the realm of Pandemonium have some kind of connection, because the Pandemonium Fortress is where the Worldstone had been before before it was taken to Sanctuary. It's the place that plane was essentially created by the destruction of Anu and Tathamet that created the Worldstone in the first place. And so it's possible the Unformed Lands are the realm of Pandemonium, because Pandemonium is everything that's not hell, heaven or hell, or the created realms like Sanctuary. Pandemonium doesn't really have a form. It's just the place where the Worldstone was. It's a shifting constantly, they were fighting a continuous battle across it, but it's a plane.
Well, don't they call it like the Scar of the Universe or something like that?
Yeah, that's one of the terms for it. So it's, who knows the place around the Pandemonium Fortress is the eternal battleground between heaven and hell, but the plane is much larger than that. And it shifts constantly. We don't know what it is. You've never seen most of it. So that's one possibility. I don't know how that worked out. But it is worth considering that since Sanctuary was a created place in the first place, and it was created by the Worldstone, and the Worldstone was essentially the last remnant of the primordial Anu, and now the Worldstone has been destroyed, the power of the Worldstone, where did it go? Like, if you call it the Unformed Lands, Sanctuary was very deliberately formed. It was made with this item. So if the Unformed Lands exist and you can reach them, what are they? Are they the place where everything that wasn't made resides? I mean, there's a lot to it, but that's something worth considering. It might be that there's a relationship between Pandemonium and Sanctuary as the two places. The Sanctuary is also the only place that was ever successfully permanently created by the Worldstone.
Yes.
Other people used the Worldstone and could only make like bubbles, that kind of worlds that existed for a time and then faded out of existence. But Sanctuary is seemingly permanent, and it has Tragul, the Dragon of Balance, that it seems to exist in and around Sanctuary, but not of Sanctuary. And that's something to consider when you talk about the quote-unquote gods that the Witch Doctors can contact in the Unformed Lands.
The interesting thing is, I wonder how important it's potentially going to be in the future of Diablo. And the reason I bring that up is because with humanity being devastated the way it has been, and with the Worldstone being gone, with everything that happened at Pandemonium Fortress, and the idea that maybe the Unformed Lands, maybe the Land of the Dead, exists as a layer between all of them, whether it's, Sanctuary. And we know from, I believe it was Diablo 2, when you're going into hell, like, you go there through Pandemonium. like that, that the, it's adjacent to it. We know that. So I'm wondering if it becomes more important. Like, we know that things can be brought back from there. We know that power can be tapped into there. And if all of those human spirits exist there and they were at some point Nephilim or becoming Nephilim, that's a whole lot of untapped power, potentially. And that could be why necromancers are involved in all of this. Maybe not necessarily just because of the power aspect, but because that has shifted the balance way too far in one direction. And maybe witch doctors become important in that, because if they can physically go there, if they can travel there and have the rights to do that, maybe they have the rights to help other people there. And if adventurers need to go there to retrieve souls or power or whatever in order to bring the eternal conflict to an end, I could see that being something that becomes much, much more important. I would also, it seems to fit too, because originally, and this is sort of like a game mechanics thing, originally back in Diablo 1, I remember there was an interview where they stated that Pandemonium was supposed to be a place that they wanted to bring players to. They reiterated this in Diablo 2, where we visit the Pandemonium Fortress, but we never got a full expansion of it. The closest we got was Diablo 3 Reaper of Souls, where we go into the fortress and tear that place apart to get to Malfiel. But like you said, that place is huge, and it was something that they always planned on doing, and I'm wondering if that opportunity is starting to come. And I'm wondering if the classes that are going to be involved as NPCs potentially are going to be the key to getting there, and maybe it's a larger important thing to what's going on. Again, I still have it in my mind that where do things that don't exist go? How is it possible to completely unmake something? But if you unmake something to its complete base components, do they still exist somewhere?
Yeah, but think about it from the other side, though. Everything in Sanctuary didn't exist. Sanctuary didn't exist. Mm-hmm. It was not a real place. And then they made it real using the World Stone. They pulled it out of nothing and made it something. Again, using the World Stones. They formed it using the World Stone. The World Stone formed Sanctuary. So the unformed lands would be what? Are they the places that they didn't make using the World Stone? Are they the places from which the World Stone drew? Or are they the World Stone?
Now that's an interesting idea.
And does the World Stone have to physically exist to exist? The World Stone dreams nothing into something.
And if
the World Stone is a manifestation of Anu's power, the power to create, the power to make things. If you can make things, first you have to conceive of them. Anu created himself into two beings because he conceived of himself as separate. He created Tathamet by conceiving of all the evil and vileness within itself, because it was everything, so of course it had those things too, being pulled out and created as a new thing, which also created the other thing, the Diamond Warrior, which was everything left when you pull all that stuff out and put it over there. Everything left behind is there. If you create a world, everything you don't create, where is it?
And interestingly enough, too, right? Like, we know that there are chunks of World Stone that exist out in the world before the World Stone no longer was there.
Oh, yeah. Someone came in and took pieces of it. They created the soul ships, the soul stones that way.
And
they were made from pieces of the World Stone.
And I believe there is also a case made that somebody think that the blood shards are also pieces of the World Stone.
Well, we know that in Diablo Immortal, pieces of the World Stone are being hunted down by the demons. They're looking for them. So ultimately, I think it's very, very interesting to think about the concept of the World Stone not as a not as a thing, an object, but as a place. You know, Sanctuary was the only thing it ever made that continued on. Why? Was it because they brought the World Stone to Sanctuary?
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that the World Stone was now contained within a world? Was that what it needed? You needed in order for the unformed lands to exist, you need a formed land. You need a place to have no place. In order for there to be nothing, you have to have something. Otherwise, everything is nothing, and then nothing is everything. These words they're only concrete and separate and disparate when they have opposites. And so the Worldstone might actually be the place they're going to. It might be the place they're visiting. It might be the place from which all these spirits and gods come from, because we know the dead were trying to get to the Worldstone. When they died, they went to Pandemonium to try and find the Worldstone, only the Worldstone wasn't there anymore. And that's the power Malthiel drew upon, was the power of death. And the necromancers seem to be able to draw upon the plane of the dead, which is, seems to be the same plane as the unformed lands.
Which seems to be the same power that the witch doctors call upon as well.
And if you die, you go to the Worldstone because you came from the Worldstone. Because the Worldstone made you. It made everything. It made the angels and the demons. Those pieces of Anu and Tathamet that made them, they were created by the same thing that destroyed the, you know, the universe and created the Worldstone. So I think there's a possibility that the Worldstone can't be destroyed. Its physical manifestation, maybe, but not the Worldstone itself.
And there's nothing that says that another physical manifestation can't take form either, right? Like
quite
that,
possibly.
Because at that point, it's essentially, it's the heart of creation. It's essentially untold potential that if everything can be created using its power, why can't it create itself? Like you pointed out, they did that originally. The Eye of Anu is the Eye of Anu because, well, that's what happened. That was the resultant outcome of, you know, a greater being splitting itself in twain because it could. It existed. It willed itself into existence. It willed itself split. The worlds themselves are made from the remnants of those beings, of that being. It is essentially pure potential. And if that being can do it, and anything exists of it, and Sanctuary is made of it, which we can argue that it is or isn't, whatever, that is entirely possible that the soul, that the Worldstone could just exist again. But I like your idea. I like the idea that because of that pure potential, because of that, that pure creation, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a physical item. It can be a place. It can be a concept, a higher concept that just exists. And if that place is the land of the dead, if it is the unformed world, then going there or tapping into it seems like the next logical place because that's where it came from to begin with, or potentially where it went after everything was physically destroyed. It's a fascinating idea to think about. And one of the existential-esque type things of Diablo that I think is always fascinating because it can mean something so different to any of those characters. And I also think that it's going to become a little more important, and this is a little bit outside of the lore aspect, simply because the game itself seems like it's trying to go back more towards its RPG roots. Well, how do you do that? You bring more meaning, more story, more investment of the characters and what's going on, aside from just clicking things to get loot. And if you add sort of that element, like you are, like they're doing with Diablo Immortal, and potentially with Diablo 4, you get the opportunity to explore some of these concepts a little deeper. And I think that's personally something that I'm looking forward to. Because like you said, Diablo has this nasty tendency of we don't always get a whole lot of backstory. We've had books, sure. We've had the Sin War. We've had the Book of Cain. We've had the Book of Tyriel. We've had some items outside of the game that sort of try to solidify some of that. But I think we can start getting to a point where the story, the lore of it, could start manifesting more solidly inside of the game. And I think they already started to do that with Diablo 3 to a certain degree. So I guess I want to end this with a question for you. With everything that we've talked about with all of the classes, with all of the lore for the classes, thinking about going into Diablo 4 now and Diablo Immortal, what would you like to see explored the most in terms of those classes and their interaction world? And yes, it can be barbarians, because I know that's, I mean, it's just, it's like peanut butter and jelly. It just goes together, Matt and Beans. But I'm curious.
Honestly, for me, the one I'm most interested in finding out about is what happened to Skovos? What's going on with the Skovos Isles? Because last we heard, they sent Amazons out into the world, and that's it. We don't know what happened since. What have they been doing? You know, did they get the eye back, the sightless eye? The sightless eye can be used to scry on the entire history of the world. Did they know what was coming? Did they, like, have a defense for it? Did they, like, you know, were they prepared for Malthiel's attack? What is going on with Skovos and the Amazons? That's the barbarians, I feel like we've seen enough in terms of, I don't worry about their story. Their story is their homeland was destroyed. They're a wandering people. They have no fixed abode. They're all just kind of trying to rebuild what they lost. I get that. I've seen it. I know what it is. But the Amazons, no idea what they've been up to since Diablo 2. So yeah, I would like there to be something about Skovos.
And for me, I think I'm getting what I want the most, which has always been the druids. And mostly because the concept of druidity inside of a grimdark setting has always fascinated me, because generally speaking, druid lore is not necessarily always tied up with, in classic storytelling, with super, super dark, like, tidings, right? So
Here's what I'm going to disagree with you, buddy.
Okay.
Because Arthur Macon exists.
Well,
and the Wicker Man exists. And in fact, for most of its history, going back to Caesar talking about the druids were always portrayed as sinister. They held knowledge that they didn't share with people. They had strange rites that they didn't discuss with outsiders, and they called upon gods that they didn't really bother to explain to the people who were writing about them. So there is actually a long tradition of druids being sinister and even a little malevolent. The whole idea of nature, red in tooth and claw, of the horned god, or the Dol Carnazain, the two-horned god, the one that sacrificed, burned people in giant wicker statues.
Servants of the darker earth, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All that stuff. That stuff is a big part of druidism. That's why I liked that in World of Warcraft, they brought it in with the Kul'tirans. Like, they had death druids. Druids who were like, part of life is death. Part of nature is decay. It's part of it. You can't have it. Like, without
there's
decay,
no life
plants
without
don't
death,
grow.
Yeah,
you know, so I think it's pretty fitting, actually, and I think it's very thematically appropriate to druids to have that element. The part where they turn into werewolves, that's a little harder, but I'm down for the werewolf turning. That's
and cool. Werebears. Don't forget werebears.
Sure. Yeah, that's fine. But yeah, I think that druids work pretty well as a sinister, not necessarily evil, but scary. Just because something isn't evil doesn't mean, it's another Dragon Age reference, but I think it works here. Never mind about that tiger. It's not its fault. It's going to eat you.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter that the animal isn't evil. It's still going to kill you, and that's frightening. The power of the druid to take animal forms, to call upon storms and lightning and earthquakes, it's still terrifying. Whether or not, they're using it for evil doesn't matter to the people they kill with it.
Right.
And that's, I think, something that's pretty cool about the Diablo version of it.
But I am looking forward to that getting explored a little bit more, seeing what they've been up to, and actually getting to see their interactions with the world in general. It's always been my favorite class, is what it really boils down to. So getting some more of them is always going to make me very, very happy. But I think that's going to do it for us today, unless there's anything else you want to bring up?
No, I'm good.
All right. Well, Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast, site, and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters can enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And if you have questions for the podcast, please be sure to send them in. You can send those in to podcast@blizzardwatch.com. You can also send those in on our Discord. We do have a Discord channel set aside for our Patreon supporters as a way of saying thank you. You can get your questions highlighted in a place that we can see them a little more directly. If you're not a Patreon supporter, an email is not your thing. We also understand. There is a Q&A podcast question section where you can drop those in there. We're going to look at both of those. Just make sure you specify which show it's for, so Matt and I don't have to mud wrestle for them. But with that, we'll see you next week.
Dude, it's Jell-O. It's not mud.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.